Welcome to the Drum History Podcast. I am your host, Bart Vanderzee, and today I'm joined by Mr. Wes Faulkner of Explorers Percussion. Wes, welcome to the show.
I'm very glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Sure, my pleasure. So today we're talking about Zikos drums, which is, I would say, a well-known brand in the drum nerd community, but maybe to people who aren't as interested in this stuff, they may have never heard of Zikos drums, but it's definitely something that's affected through the acrylic drums, really made a huge impact on drumming.
Back during the time, I think the very first time I got to see one of his drum sets was probably close to around 72 when they had the newer lugs and stuff on them and everything. And they were very futuristic looking because, we're just now getting into the more plastic, acrylic world. And we saw them, it was very futuristic,
Yeah.
And seeing them and everything was a very new type of material. You see something made out of, you can see through it. And I was wow, you can see through these, these drums and everything. So it was really cool to see them.
Yeah.
And I remember the most popular set I always saw was they called it the 400 drum set, which was 214 rack toms, an 18-inch floor tom, and then the deep long bass drum. And that was $750 and brand new.
That's expensive for obviously for back then. I mean, and those are huge sizes. But all right. So as you kind of alluded to, these are very early, some would say the first acrylic drums, but why don't we rewind a little bit and let's talk about Bill Zikos, the inventor, founder of the company, who this was in Kansas City. You're in Kansas City, Missouri. So this was kind of in your the suburbs around you, correct?
Right. Yeah. I mean, like I said before, we talked in the past that, there's a kind of a dual city. Kansas City, Missouri is the main metropolis, but there's also Kansas City, Kansas. So all the big suburbs around on the Kansas side are really kind of suburbs of still Kansas City, Missouri. Sure. And that's where he kind of settled in the early to mid 60s, where he did a lot of teaching. But, couple of the big school districts there, like Shawnee Mission School District, and he worked with a lot of the school bands, and he composed music that they played. And Bill Zikos also worked with little percussion ensembles back then within the schools. He had lots of students, and they even did sometimes halftime shows at the Kansas City Chiefs games back in the 60s. Oh, wow. And everything. So he kind of had a little thing invented, kind of like four or five drum sets together. They did kind of a quartet drum sets, and I think it was later on went to UMKC Conservatory that was they used it over there a lot too, and people would take breaks and solo away, you'd kind of get them a little motif going and everything. But, but yeah, Bill though was mostly a big band drummer. I think he played in the Stan Kenton band and a couple other bands as well. And before he came back to Kansas City, and I think he grew up in Fulton, Missouri, which is not too far away from here.
That's great. So obviously his background, like you said, as a performer, I'm sure he was tinkering around with drums, but so you said he was building some kits for his students, right? Was that, those were not acrylic though at that point, right?
Yeah, not that I know of. I know that he had a little small, where he taught drum lessons at. Half the shop was kind of mostly drums, and half the shop was guitars and other musical instruments. He was really into sonar drums a lot. Mm. And he really loved sonar drums. That's what he was playing for. He, of course, came out with his own drums. But I did ask him, what did you first think of, the clear drums and everything, the clear drums would be cool. And he said that he was late 50s, what he told me.
Hmm.
But one of the first things I heard he started doing was he was ordering, when he had his little shop, he was ordering drum heads from Bob Beals, who ran, Evans Drum Heads, which was out in Dodge City at that time, Dodge City, Kansas. And he was special ordering drums. He was actually, I think, taking the coating off the coated drum heads, which would then be clear because they're just, sprayed, the coating was sprayed on the clear heads. And he was asking them to especially, just send the heads without the coating on there. So he's one of the first guys that actually kind of innovated clear drum heads to a certain extent too. And later on, definitely was a big influence on the hydraulic head, the two ply head with the real oil in the middle, not the, a lot of people kind of thought, you know, pinstripes and emperors were oil too. So he had a big influence on that as well. What I think made the clear heads, some think might have gave him the idea at the time to go into clear drums. But he, like I said, he told me that he thought of clear drums back in the late 50s and everything. Mm. So,
you know, and I mentioned it, I did an episode about just kind of broad acrylic drums, which we didn't go deep into Zikos or anything much on that. But I remember mentioning that, like, there's also the, like, whole thing where, like, plastic became more readily available. And you think of, like, I think of, like, skateboard wheels, where they turned into, like, you know, they went from being hard to, like, this more, like softer rubber. And it was all around that time of, like, the late 50s, early 60s. So I guess it's the materials became more accessible, and he saw it as an opportunity, which is pretty innovative.
It's very true. Yeah, I think I can remember as a kid, like, around, you didn't really start seeing even plastic in cars till, like, around 68. There might have been very little in it before that, because it was all metal, you know? And So plastic, I remember my dad got a new car in 1968, and he started seeing the plastic. Then by, like, you know, a couple years later, 70 or early 70s and everything, you saw a lot more plastic in the cars and taken away from the metal and everything. Yeah. So I always say, like I said, that's why the acrylic drums looked very futuristic back then. And of course, I think Ludwig came out with their clear, the Vislites, like around 73 was in the catalog, but they weren't, I don't think there were very many in the stores yet.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, his drums were very, very, very futuristic. I think the first set he made, by the way, did have sonar hardware on it, had sonar lugs and everything.
That's neat. I know sonar guys would like to hear that. It's always neat to piece together little bits of history like that. But all right, so do you know more details, though, like that first time he was in his shop? I mean, maybe he's obviously more like inventive than me, but it's not like you can just go out and, like, you know, heat some plastic over clear plastic over a candle and melt it. You know, like, how did that process go?
Yeah, I'm not for sure exactly how they made that first kit. It was pretty crudely done before they got they had a big oven, which was like a big pizza oven. I think it was like around 8 feet wide and 4 feet deep. And but I think what they did at first, it was very crude the way they did it. They didn't have like a regular, you know, obviously a full size oven or anything. Mm-hmm. But I do know that they did make their shells. He had like these molds. When he heated up the acrylic, they went around the molds. So it was kind of from the outside around the mold.
Mm-hmm.
And I do know that Ludwig made theirs from the inside of the mold, but there's an inside. So
interesting.
But he did have in mind when he did, his shells were a quarter inch thick. They were thicker than anybody else's, even in the future. I think the Ludwig drums were like around 3/16 thick. So he advertised that too. And supposedly he did get a patent like around 1970. So, and that was always advertised in his little pamphlets, you know, they're patented because they're so unique and everything. But
was that patent on like clear acrylic drums? I mean, how did that work with like Fibes, Ludwig, you know, various companies doing, because most companies had acrylic drums not too far after that. Was that a big problem for him?
I think it was at first. And I think they did call Ludwig or had, you know, send an attorney send a letter to them and everything. They just pretty much laughed and everything. They said, you know, we don't care. You know, we're just going to keep on doing what we're doing. Hmm. And I think they made a few sets with Ludwig hardware too. Now, there's only a few of them. It's because the first set was had the sonar hardware on it, sonar lugs. I think it had a Camco. They used Camco double tom holders a lot.
Yep.
And one reason why too, because Camco was then out in Chanute, Kansas, which was not that far away on the Kansas side. And they were pretty good holders back then for that time. So the first set was made for Ron Bush, you know, the Iron Butterfly drummer.
Oh wow!
That was the very first drum set, and then second set was made for Keith Moon, and he used Slingerland hardware on that, Slingerland lugs. And then the third set was a demo kit that was had Slingerland lugs as well, that was supposed to kind of go with to Bill Ward of Black Sabbath, but he never did supposedly buy it. But I think I did see him playing a clear set of, you know, Zico's there around the mid-70s. I think it was like the Volume 4 album.
Man.
I think inside that album, he's playing a clear set of Zico's drums. But
those are like, I mean, I think there's a lot of independent drum builders today who, I know it was different in the 60s and 70s, but like, man, I mean, your first kind of, I don't want to use the term endorsers, but you know what I mean? Like your first guys are using them are, let's say, Sabbath and The Who, and we'll throw Iron Butterfly in there because they're maybe not the biggest band in the world, but Inagata De Vida is obviously a part of like rock history.
Sure.
Those are like the biggest drummers you could ever get in the world playing your drums.
Very true. Very true. And it's like, you know, like 69 was the Ron Bushy set. That was a big Inagata Vida drum solo. That solo there was, it had a lot of influence on people. You know, that was a solo, you know, I mean, for rock drummers, you know, back in the 4-1, you know, the 4-4 bass drum, you know, thing going on and everything.
Yeah.
So in 72, then they got their own lug casing, so their own, you know, design and everything. But backing up a little bit, though, one little thing a lot of people don't know about Zico's is that he had a little bit the guy that had the other side of the music store, his name was Mike Wagner. They formed a production company called the MWZ Production Company. They brought some of these bands in to Kansas City. And when they came in there to the venue to play, which is usually this place called Memorial Hall over in on the Kansas City, Kansas side, he would bring a clear kit down there and show them the drums and everything. Mm-hmm. And that's how he kind of, you know, I guess you could say, you know, homegrown direct advertising there.
Yeah.
And a lot of times when they did this, they had these stamps they made where they would stamp their names on the drum heads, whatever drummer that was, and they brought the drums down there. So this Bill Ward drum set is still around Kansas City.
Cool.
And you can see, I've seen it before, and it's just a nice little stamp on the, nothing fancy, just a little, his name, you know, Bill Ward on the clear heads and everything. It's kind of cool. That's neat. That's really kind of nice homegrown, you know, playing. In fact, the first time, might have been technically second, but I think it was the first time that when Led Zeppelin came to Kansas City, Bonham played a Zico's kit.
Whoa, that is
deep
on so many levels, because obviously like Zeppelin, you think Ludwig, but on top of that, you think the Amber Vista Lights. So,
yes,
nuts. That's awesome.
And actually, they did two shows. And I think the second show, not to get off record here, but, off the beat here, but he supposedly got really sick, and at about second or third song, he just like threw up all over his drums. And one of Bill Zico's students finished the show
with Zeppelin.
Yes.
Oh my God.
I don't know. I can't really, I don't know the kid's name that did it, but yeah, in fact, he was using, it was actually his drum set. I think he was like, this is before John Bonham was, you know, a big legend and everything. He's like really excited. It's, you know, rock star was playing his drums and everything. And all of a sudden, then John got sick and threw up all over the drums and everything. So,
man, you think of those, like the stories of Keith Moon passing out from like horse tranquilizers. It's like, I wonder if John Bonham was like, he had food poisoning, or if he was like completely partied out or something, you know?
Yeah. I think it was in between shows. I think he was just, you know, drinking a lot. Someone said it was his birthday. He was celebrating, but I think I looked at the date before. I don't think it was his birthday. I don't think that had any continuity there between his birth date and the day that they were in town that night. But I will say one thing too, Bill Zico's wife, her name was Barbara Zico. She was quite instrumental in a lot of the booking all these bands and stuff too. And also working within the Zico's company and everything. So it was kind of a,
that's awesome. Can we, I just want to clarify our dates here a little bit. So what would you say was the, like, when was the founding of Zico's drum company, like in the history of the company? If someone goes, oh, I love Zico's, it started in like Ludwig 1909, you know, what was Zico's starting date?
I'd say like 1969, probably when they made that first drum set for, but it became Zico's Corporation though in like 1972.
Wow.
So you had all these sets, you know, they had ones with Sonar, you know, that Sonar lugs on it. Then you had the, you know, the ones with the very few that had, you know, Slingerland lugs on them, but they also made some sets that had, the Camco lugs on it too. I think there's like around 20 kits were made with Camco hardware on them. Those are very, very early kits. Again, it was like 69 to 71 or so, you know, when all those, the mixture of these different sets, different hardware, you know, was made. But another, the 20 kits that were made with them. And I think, like I said, a few sets I think were made with Ludwig lugs. Then Ludwig said, no, we're not going to, you know, when they get ready to come out their clear drums, they cut them off. And then, of course, they had their disagreements with the patent and all that stuff as well. But so 72, it became a corporation. My understanding is that one of Zico's students' father helped, and he made an investment into the company. So he was like, you know, say stockholder or one of the big investors. And that was kind of one of the maybe errors that maybe Bill might have made there, because he let him have 51% of the company.
Oh boy.
So, and down the road, there was some issues with, you know, I guess some conflicts with money. You know, they were like, they thought there was, he was eating, like, but the money was being, used or some other type of conflict. And one day Bill Zico's came to work, and they pretty much told him they didn't need him anymore. You know?
Oh man. It's kind of like the George Way thing, where like he goes home for lunch and then they just send him a message. What is it? John Rashawn. They're like, don't come back from lunch. We don't need you here.
Very similar to that. Yeah, it's very similar. And I think it, next, that's when it became Zico's Corporation. And I was told by one, the good friend that works there, named Dave Dyke. He's really a very knowledgeable guy that works there. He's kind of pretty much a very important person that played a big important part in the company. He said that they bought like 50,000, like the lugs, the tension rods, and the little claw hook. Like they bought 50,000 pieces all at the same time, you know. So it's a big plus, you know, as far as going forward and becoming a, you know, regular drum company. And I think they were probably, I would say, like around 1974, you know, 75 was probably when they were at their peak, you know. But I did hear too that Bill Zico is like late 71, very early 72 is when he left the company. But then he was asked to come back though too. Once it became the corporation, he came back and later on in 72. But then he left again. Huh. So
yeah, it's also similar to North Drums. Doing that story with Roger North, it was like the founder leaving and then coming back and then not having, you know, like they need him and all that stuff. Now on the Camco stuff. So this is, I have two huge regrets, drum wise in my life. And one was recently where I was selling. So long story short, I was selling a camera that I had that I used for work, like, you know, doing video stuff, and selling it for like $700, expecting to get $600 right at the time. And I'm a big believer in, if you sell like gear or a camera, then that money shouldn't go back into, like, don't pay your mortgage or whatever with that money. Take that money and like buy more drums or buy more.
All right.
I was going to buy a computer, or put money towards a computer. Then on Facebook Marketplace, a Zico's set pops up that had Camco hardware that I believe he said was like 69 or 70.
See, that was real early. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
There.
And it was, and I don't think I have, I should have like screenshotted a picture of it or something, just to save, which as I'm talking, I'll kind of look, but I kept being, it was like $650 for, I think it was the Camco hardware. There was no snare. I'm assuming they didn't usually come with snares, but it was two toms and a floor tom and a 22 inch bass drum, I think. And I was like, I probably could have just like bought the drums and then taken the money that I sold from the camera and kind of replenished that in like a savings account, but I didn't. And I was like, do you still have it? I'm still waiting to sell this camera. The guy sold them. And like 3 days later, I ended up selling the camera for the exact amount of money that I needed to buy this Zico strum set. So I will probably regret that for the rest of my life.
That's very rare, for sure. Very rare. You know?
Yeah. And I think they were in like somewhere kind of middle of Ohio or maybe in Indiana. And if anyone's curious, the second one was a set of fives. The second giant mistake I've ever made was I missed getting this really cool set of fives for like, no joke, like $75 for the full set. Clearly, whoa, a person who didn't know the value of what they had. And he said, you just missed it. And then he also texted me and said, I've gotten like 90 messages about this. So those are my two. And you know, you think about it every once in a while. You're like, man, that Zico's kit.
Well, you might get the chance again. You might get the chance again.
Yeah, it might come back up again. What are those? We'll get back on like the history stuff, but what do they typically go for? Like that set. I mean, obviously, I just said, I think there was some scratches and, you know, it wasn't in perfect shape. It had the original bass drum head with the Zico's, but like, what do they typically run for nowadays if you're trying to get your hands on old Zico's?
I think it's all over the place. I mean, again, it depends on what the person, you know, if they know what they've got. You know, a lot of people these days, they look on the internet, they'll see someone's asking what they're asking for a drum set. That's the price they'll think. That's what things are going for.
Yeah.
But that's really what people are asking for something. So it's not really it's not sold. It's probably still for sale. So it might be on the really low inside, might be on the very high inside. But I would say the average Zico set now is probably, you know, and it's been in really, really clean condition, maybe like $800 to $1,200. And you might even find some sets for around $500 or $600. You know, the thing about clear drums is that they can, they get scratched up pretty easy. You know, it's almost like satin flame type finish drums. It shows a lot of scratches very easy, or chrome drums. They look great when they've been taken care of and they're clean and everything. But if you don't, you know, if you're doing gigs and everything, you're tearing down, setting them up, then, you know, there's going to be probably some marks on them, and you get yellowing factors and stuff like that. Zico's drums didn't have too much of that, but there's a few plating issues once in a while. You might see like the chrome might be coming off, you know, mainly on the hoops, or there might be some small little cracks. Like a lot of people back in the 70s took their front heads off the bass drums. They took their heads off the bottom of the toms and everything. But for clear drums, it was usually better. You had a lot of tension at the very top of the head to have both heads on top and bottom. Mm-hmm. Because especially you have a seam there, you get the tension pulling from the very top side. It wants to split open the seam and everything. And it happened a lot on bass drums, even with Ludwig, I know, where you get the tom-toms on the bass drum and they don't get the bass drum ever high enough, and you get the front head off. A lot of times the bass drum would split open or something, you know. So,
well, it's like a guitar, where if you have a guitar with like the strings off of it for a long time, it's like that's really not good for the neck.
That's true. I never thought about that. That's probably very true too. Yeah, it starts going their direction, kind of maybe, or if too much tension could probably do the Zach, can maybe, you know, bow it in a little bit, I guess too. But I mean, I think some drums, it just depends how they're taken care of, you know. They're in cases for a long time and not taken out for gigs a lot. They're going to be probably very, you know, clean. They're stored in the right places. But I'd say the average price selling them, again, but it's probably like, you know, X at 800 to 1,000 if they're, you know, pretty clean. So not a lot.
Yeah.
Not crazy money. I mean, one thing about the sale of all these drums and everything too, like in the late 70s, I think, it was kind of clear drums, maybe because of Ludwig, how it came out with all different colors and everything. There was just so many of them out there for a while. I think it kind of hurt the price of them a little bit. So we went into business in like around 1984. People were getting rid of like clear kits like crazy. And I think wood kits were really in style. Like, you know, Tama was coming out with their Superstar kits. And of course, the Imperial Star with more covered kits. But they had, you know, Billy Cobham and Neil Peart was advertising all these wood drums and Simon Phillips and stuff. So people were just went like from clear to wood, the totally, you know, opposite direction.
Sure.
And so we took in a lot of clear kits back in the 80s. And they were probably, that's probably when the price of those drums were kind of bottomed out, you could say. But
yeah,
kind of interesting.
You've made me feel better, though, about not getting that kit for, because I thought $625, I was like, oh my God, this is the best deal in the world. But it sounds like that's honestly about right. Like he did his homework.
Yeah, probably so. And then, you know, you got the set with the Zico's lugs on it, you're going to get all those other features too that he kind of like advertised, which is a big deal, which they were kind of futuristic in a way as far as at the time, you know, compared to other drum companies. You know, he had the bigger tension screws. They were thicker, supposedly thicker and stronger and everything. That, of course, only his tension screws worked on his drums. There were no springs in the lugs or anything. You had the little plastic sleeves or gaskets behind the lugs, you know, to isolate. I mean, of course, no springs and everything. It cuts down all the, you know, vibration sound of the springs and everything. The buzzing sounds used to have a lot on the drums with the, in the studio and everything. But, of course, they came with two-ply heads back then when they got them going in 72. And the quick-release hoops, which was cool, which was very similar to the Miazzi drums. Back then, the Miazzi out of Italy was a the lug was very similar to the Miazzi lug. And
can you explain that quick release? Because I'm looking at the pictures online, and I think I mean, if you see it, you kind of understand it. But how does that quick release system work?
Well, basically, there's like a little round roller pin that the tension rod went down into, and then the tension rod, you know, like where the washer would be, it has that little claw hook, and that hooked into that little slot. There's like little cut out slots around the counter hoop that it hooked into. So you just had to back off this tension rod just a couple of turns, and then you just pulled out away from the drum, and you could change the head a lot quicker.
Yeah. It's cool. It's smart. I feel like I've seen that elsewhere, and it's kind of escaping me, but that technology.
Yeah. Tama brought it back in the late 80s. They had a snare drum that they brought back. I think it's around 87 or 88. That's when I remember right. They brought back kind of a Gladstone drum too. It was kind of a different concept. They were kind of looking at other people's drums and everything. And sure. I think they brought it back again though, and it was kind of popular in some of their drums in the 2000s too. They're the only cup I remember that they did that. And the roller pin, of course, could come out very easily too. You had to kind of line it up with the hole and everything. But and it's, you had the curved spurs, which is, you know, before Ludwig had theirs out, which was definitely an idea from the Camco style.
For sure.
And all the lugs and tension rods worked for all the drums, which made it really simple. You didn't have to have different lengths or anything. Or different size lug casings, you know, for like the toms, the bass drum, or snare drum. So they were all the same size. Of course, I had to stagger them on the snare drums because they're too big. Which, and there's not a lot of Zico snare drums out there anyway. So they use the same claw and hook design too on the bass drum rims too, because they had to use those metal hoops. So there's no wood hoops or anything. So
now, why were there less snare drums? I mean, because when I think about it, I think like typically companies like maybe they make more snare drums than drum sets. Because people, it's easier to buy a snare than it is to buy a set for the most part. Why didn't they make more snares?
Yeah, that's a good point. A great question. I don't really know why. That's another reason why you probably could have like marketed the drums with the snare drum, get a snare drum out there, and later on, you know, buy the drum set, you know, kind of motion on that too. But they didn't do that. Usually, we saw his drums in the music store. He had the three toms and the bass drum. And I know that I could say, well, maybe because they didn't have their own throw off made or their snare strainer, but they usually use, I saw probably more Slingerland Zoomatics on their snare drums than any other model used. But that's a good question. I don't know why the snare drums there wasn't more emphasis on the snare drums, because a lot of their tom toms were 14 inch and the hoops and everything. You know, they had to cut a hole for the snare wires and put a snare bed in there, and you get, you know, snare bed. That snare drum is born, you know, besides, you know, getting the right throw off is picked. But
also similar to North, where you don't see many of the North snare drums with these. And I'm only kind of using them as parallels because they're sort of independent, smaller companies that got bought up and then that, you know, grew and were more homegrown, like you said.
Right. North snare drums are probably more rare than Zico snare drums. Those are super rare. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, the snare drum is one of the more complex drums to make too. in some ways, getting it right.
Sure.
You know, but still, though, he could have done it very easily. You know, and the ones he had were pretty decent.
This episode is brought to you by Forks Drum Closet, Nashville's full-line drum store. Celebrating its 40th year in business, Forks is independently owned and operated in the heart of Music City. Specializing in drums and percussion, Forks offers great discounts on all major brands and will beat any retailer's advertised price. From new and used equipment, vintage drums, and marching and orchestral instruments, Forks has something for every drummer. They also offer professional rental, repair and restoration services, as well as drum lessons. Stop by their storefront at 308 Chestnut Street, Nashville, Tennessee. Call 615-383-8343 or go online at ForksDrumCloset.com. This episode is brought to you by Dream Cymbals. Dream just sent me over 5 cymbals to try out, including the Dark Matter Bliss Paper Thin Crash in 17, 18, and 19 inches, and 2 Dark Matter Bliss Crash Rides in 20 and 22, and these cymbals are awesome. They're dark, they're gritty, they're explosive, and they're just super unique. Beyond how they sound, though, they look like they were buried for a year, dug up, lit on fire, buried, lit on fire again, and then sold to you. They just look so cool, and I highly recommend them. Learn more at dreamcymbals.com and find them on social media at Dream Cymbals. All right, now looking at the timeline here, so founded 69-ish, 72, they became a corporation, 74 to 75, you said was the peak. So that's when they're just like, you know, what was the shop like? Was this still being, was everything, I know we were outsourcing like lugs and hardware and stuff, and I guess you said it, but they started making that at some point. What was the factory, if you can call it a factory, you know what I mean? What was that looking like?
I think they had regular, you know, drill jigs and everything for their drums, you know, to make things more precise and take less time and be more accurate. And they had a lot, and actually a lot of people that worked there, a lot of their employees were drummers. You know, I've talked to a lot of people over the years. Yeah, I used to work in the Zico's, you know, drum factory for a while. You know, I've heard that from a few people. And so it was really set up like a regular factory. I know that, I think back in the early 70s, like 72, they might have been like maybe making 4 or 5 kits a day. But I think around 70, like around 74, it was like around 10 kits a day or so, probably. Hmm. Which was like on the big scale, wasn't a lot for us. That's a very small, you know, boutique company compared to what someone like probably Ludwig would make a day, you know.
Yeah.
But I was also heard that talking to Dave Dykes that worked there, he told me that they were considering, they were talking to Jasper, and they actually for a short time period were considering making some wood drums for a while.
Oh.
So
makes sense. I mean,
they actually
why
considered
not?
It. Yeah, they kind of considered just kind of just to widen their, you know, scope on drums in their market a little bit, but it never did happen.
Yeah. Now, like, I'm always interested in this. If you're making 10 kits a day and the demand is pretty, you know, pretty high, how does distribution typically work for companies like that? Because like the ones I was looking at, that was in Trenton, Ohio. How does it spread around for distribution? Did they typically send some kits to major stores around the country, or how does that process work?
Yeah, I think that's pretty much how it worked. It was, they didn't have any distributors, from what I understand. They had no distributors in Europe or anywhere else, but, you know, just their own home office here in Kansas City. Most everything was made in Kansas City area. Only a couple of things were made out of Kansas City. So a lot of people, I think, that brought them over, like I've heard of, you know, or is it Great Britain or Holland or wherever. I think it was just someone that was, would actually call them up and just order some drums and bring that. He brought them into, or they would bring them into their country by handful of kits, and that's how they got brought into them. So it wasn't like, it was a very, very small scale thing. It wasn't like a distributor, you know, ordering, you know, 30 kits or 50 kits or something. It wasn't like that. I don't think it was never a distributor. It was mostly, it was mostly stores and everything. So he told me, I kind of a funny story about Keith Moon. I told him he got his first kit. I guess when he paid, I guess they had problems getting paid for the kit. I guess they were buying the kits back then, instead of getting endorsed like they do now. And I guess they called Keith Moon a couple of times. And every time they called his house, his wife would say, he's down at the pub. Call there again, a couple more days later, hey, well, he's down at the pub. So he's kind of hard to get hold of. It's kind of a funny story.
And that is funny, but it's kind of a, it's funny, but I'm sure Bill was like, okay. Need to get paid for this, because I'm sure shipping, I mean, you're looking at like putting it ship. I mean,
shipping was very expensive over there. It was a very shipping ship that, I mean, all his drums over there as well. It was very expensive.
Jeez. Well, hopefully he ended up getting paid. I mean, and you know, it's funny too, because like Keith Moon, Bill Ward, both English drummers. So that pretty cool. I wonder how many Zikos drums there are floating around, the used market in Europe.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting, but probably not very many. I don't think it would be that many, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, the truth is kind of count how many, Heyman kits are over here, you know?
Exactly. I at the Chicago show recently, a couple months ago, I saw one or two, which they're like oddities almost, you know? It's like, it's more like, you just don't see them. But they're really cool. They're beautiful drums. So, all right, 74, 75, you got a peak, but typically with a peak, that means you're going down after that. So what happened as the peak dropped off?
I heard they went to they're still making drums up to like around 1977 or so. And then I think they were just stacked down to like just selling parts and stuff after that for the next few years, you know? So I do remember seeing the Zikos Corporation in the phone book here locally, like around 1980 or 81 or so. But I think they were just selling off the rest of the parts and stuff. So that's kind of, then of course, Bill started making drums again back in the 90s, and then they come back. But that's kind of going forward. I guess the one thing we could maybe mention here in the history was the supersonic drums and those artistry drums back then. I guess, Bill Zikos had a non-compete agreement with the guy who owned, had the 51%, which was, I think his name was Fred McGraw. We can draw up saying names here or not. But I guess Bill came out that artistry kit, which was called the egg drums. They're kind of shaped like eggs. Have you ever saw those, or fiberglass drums?
No, I haven't. I'll have to look it up.
Yeah, and they're like eggs, and it wasn't very many of them made. You know, I mean, like 20 or 30 kits. And so in reaction to that, they came out with that supersonic kit, which were the kits that had like, I think a 13 to 15 inch rack tom, 18 inch floor tom. And then the other side was a smaller head, like 18 inch had a 14 inch smaller head, the 15 had a 12, and the 13 inch rag tom, which were big rag toms, had a 10 inch on the other side. So you could play both sides if you wanted to. The 22 inch bass drum had a 16 on the other side, which was reduced down. These were fiberglass as well. And that was a reaction to these artistry drums. You just made those, and they made, I guess, 100, 150 kits of those, white, blue, and red, I think. And that was kind of interesting. You see them out there. They're kind of a rarity. If you type in Zico supersonic drum, you can
see them. Yeah, they're very, they're just interesting looking. They almost like, I know they're different, but like they remind me almost of like the PV drums or something. Yeah. They're just they don't look anything like that, but they're just so outlandish looking. It's almost just like,
kind of like Jetsons.
It's like a Jetsons thing. And I kind of just explained it, but like, so you said you can flip it over and play both sides, but like
you could, yeah.
Why do they look like this? And everyone should just Google Zikos, Zikos, supersonic, and you'll see. But like, what is the benefit of this?
I don't know how much science is really behind it. I think it, because it's like, in a way, it'd make more sense to be the other way. The smaller head would be your main, batter side, and the bigger head on the bottom side for your resonant head. But that was just reality, what they kind of thought of then, A lot of people looked at those drums too, and they called them it looked like kind of like an old washer, washer,
I mean, if someone's like driving and can't look it up, to describe it, it's basically, it kind of looks normal at the top, normal head, and then it goes down. And then I guess the fiberglass kind of bevels in, maybe an inch, and then there's a rim that's like inset, but it's not flush. It's kind of sticking out. Like, it's almost like it's sitting on top, but I'm sure it's connected and has like an edge and all that stuff. But it does look like an old washing machine. It's super Jetsons-ish.
And it had all those regular Zico's lugs on it and Zico hoops, and, you know, the call, quick release, you know, tension rods and stuff. So it was kind of cool. The artistry drums did not. They had their own, those egg-shaped, the egg drums, as they call them. They did not. And those are really hard to find a picture of. We've had a hit of those before. But I will say, there's an Al Green drummer. I don't remember his name, but I think he was also B.B. King's drummer. Hmm. He's on a video, and then the song's called Love. And it's like L-O-V-E. It's like 1975. And he's playing one of those artistry egg-shaped sets. He actually does a little solo. It wasn't like, wasn't Soul Train, but it was one of those TV shows back then. So it's kind of cool to see that. Yeah.
Now, can you just real quick, like, so just to clarify, Zico's made the artistry series, correct? Or was that that was Zico's, right?
Yeah, that was him. So that set was really, the Supersonic kit was still by the, you know, Zico's Corporation without Bill Zico's.
Oh,
you
know, I so see. That was, I see.
Yeah.
And that's where the non-compete problem came in, where he said, you know, hey, Bill, you're basically kind of doing, you're not supposed to be doing that.
Right. So I tell you, some reaction to it. He just like made all these other, you know, Supersonic drums and stuff.
Okay.
And as a reaction, instead of like, you know, taking the cord over or whatever. So I guess he wasn't really, you know, he was selling drums. It wasn't selling clear drums. So I don't know what the particulars were in the agreement, but yeah. So it's kind of interesting.
It is. What was the name he was operating under as by himself, not as Zico's Corporation, but what was he calling himself for the drums?
You know, that's a good question. What in Zico's Corporation? I think it was just Zico's Drums, you know, because just using his name, you know, and he only had like a couple, one store I know here was selling them. Might have been a couple of stores selling them because there wasn't very many of those drums, you know, sold at all.
Yeah. So, I mean, everyone's got to be thinking it, the parallel to like Ludwig and WFL with that, but he couldn't, you know, WFL couldn't use the Ludwig name. So they must have had a different,
right. Good point.
Thing.
And there was that lawsuit with them because in a very small print in that late 30s badge, you know, had the, you know, founder was, you know, William F. Ludwig. And then,
yeah, God,
he got taken to court for having that on those badges and everything.
For so his I don't own think. Name.
Yeah, I think there's very many of those, you know, were made. And a lot of people, there's a couple I know use those for, like in videos later on, you know, like in the 80s, like on MTV. I think there was some band I heard that they'd use those. But that only video I've ever seen is that Al Green drummer in 1975. It's kind of, it's a strange looking kit, especially for, it's strange and very strange now. I'm sure it's super strange back then.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that's nuts. And it almost seems like as the peak kind of dies down, you said like, mid to late 70s, like 77, 78, then it gets to where you were also saying about how people were just getting rid of acrylic drums left and right, getting into the 80s. So it sort of seems natural, like it just sort of ran its course.
Yeah, I think it's kind of slowed down a lot. I think when Ludwig came out with the Tivoli drums, the lights, and he had all the different stripes, and you had like, you know, like a six or so different, you know, patterns to choose from, they just, you know, they, I mean, how much, and it was a crazy time, you know, it was very busy, you know, sure in the mid 70s for those, for Vislite drums and everything, but I think they just kind of exhausted it, you know, to the peak. And by the early 80s, you know, it was kind of, people were kind of ready to, you know, do something else. I mean, the business is, there's always a trend side to the music business, you know, and whereas the depth of your shells or the depth of your bass drum, size of the bass drums, it's very trendy, certain colors, you know, where it's solid colors to burst or to fades.
Sparkles.
I mean, sparkles, yeah. You know, and stuff. Some, you know, like when sparkles can, even like Satin Flames, sparkles, we started bringing those back, you know, like probably in the last 20 years. And you get a lot of older people, older drummers, you know, to come in the store, our store, they'll see those, like, what's the big deal, man? We've already done this, you know? But again, you get new customers, you know, it's kind of like bringing, like, always like bringing the bell bottoms back in the fashion industry.
Yeah.
Every 10 years or something. Like, it's new people, new generation hasn't seen it. So
yeah,
that's kind of what happened with Clear Drums, I think, you know, in the late 90s, you know, in early 2000s, when that, you know, Bill kind of brought him back, and when he started back up again, and it was still kind of early, you know, and Fives came back, you know, with when Tommy Dan Austin, you know, bought Fives' name and everything, but still wasn't really coming back. And then, you know, of course, Pearl's making Clear Drums, you know, Tama brought the Clear Drums back, and now DW's making that too. And yeah, so, and they're still, you know, they can buy a nice new set for, you know, $1,200, $1,500, you know.
Exactly. So, exactly. I always kind of think about it where I'm like, you know, you can get a nice high-end DW or Tama kit for $1,200. And then you kind of got to think to yourself, though, like, okay, it's plastic. It's not really a DW like collector series or whatever. There's sort of that, like, yes, it is what it is. I mean, and that raises the question, which maybe you can shine some light on, like, company to company, and I probably asked this in the acrylic episode, company to company, Z-Coast, Fibes to Vistalite. I know there's different manufacturing techniques and seamless and inside of the form and outside of the form. Is there any difference when you're really playing these drums? Because they're just, there's not wood, they're just plastic.
I mean, difference between different brands, you mean?
Yeah, like the sound. Is Z-Coast going to sound different than Fibes, really?
You know, I think the timbre and the overall, you know, sound is going to be pretty much very, very, very similar, you know, because you got a very hard reflective, you know, surface you have there, you know. Unlike, you know, of course, you got like those stainless steel drums that were just, you know, they're metal, that again, they're very reflective too. You're going to be a little more canny sounding. They're kind of, I think, more thinner sounding, yeah. But they're very loud drums, like the, you know, Fives and fiberglass. Again, what do you have? They have a very hard surface, you know.
Sure.
I think what really made a big difference in the sound, I think Z-Coast with a thicker shell, and his bearing edges were a little bit, made a little more contact with the drum head, weren't quite as lively and ringy as the like Ludwig drums and stuff. And Fives is super loud too. You know, and then later on when he came back, you know, in the '90s and making his shells, he had like almost a round over bearing edge, and which made a lot of contact, a lot more contact with the head. And you could even put a single ply head on those drums then, and which is very unusual, because most everybody that played clear drums, when the two ply heads came out, everybody was using those. You know, if you bought a new Vistalite kit with silver dot heads on there, and you had the bottom clear heads on there, they were very loud. You know, it was a 40 head, they had the muffled bass drum heads and things like that. So sound was just, you know, just crazy loud. So, but it wasn't, I don't think it was like a really big difference overall in between them all. I don't think so. It's just very minimal. Of course, his, again, Deco's had the two fly heads, and you could buy them with hydraulic heads too. So again, yeah, he kind of knew that, you know, that he just slowed down the vibrations a little bit somehow.
No, that's a good answer. And I don't think we've officially said it yet, but just to kind of throw it out there for the, you know, the sake of history. And I know that it's hard to determine who did what first, because typically, like we said, things are going on with multiple places. And we may have said this earlier, but is it fair to say generally that Bill Z-Coast did invent the acrylic drums?
I think so. Yeah, I really do. I think he was the first one, you know, that made a very, I guess you could say, first home run or first hit out there in the marketplace. You know, they had him. I mean, you know, I'm sure other people was thinking about it. It's like, how many people were thinking about, you know, going to the moon, maybe different countries, you know, back in the day. So, I mean, yeah. I mean, I'm being kind of out there a little bit, but I'm just saying, though, I mean, I'm sure there's someone else thinking about it, but it's basically who really has the idea, you know, and gets it done. And he really did it. And he did it, I think, in a good way. I mean, you know, we came up with all the extra features of his drums. And as I mentioned earlier, too, some of his lingo and, you know, some of the verbiage in his pamphlets were kind of very forward thinking too. You know, he kind of says here, I'm gonna say one thing, is don't mind me quoting this real quick. Z-Coast drums make a sound you haven't heard before. They put together thunder at your fingertips, soft, the heartbeat whisper, or slick stick smashing sounds. Z-Coast sound is a rich, explosive experience. And he uses the word organic a couple of times too. It's this organic unity in the sound. It's part of the tonal concept, you know, and he kind of says stuff like, you know, you can breathe on these Zico's drums, and, you know, it's just kind of an interesting, you know, way.
Really cool.
Explained the sound of the drums and everything, which, you know, it's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Kind of hip.
It's very hip. It's very progressive. And, you know, we love that stuff as drummers. We like that. Like, you know, it kind of gets you amped up about your drums. It's not just like, you know, acrylic drums. Here's the sizes. Here's the whatever. It's more like, you know, just thunderous drums. It's really good writing.
Well, I think the thing about, you know, Bill Zico's, just knowing him myself, I mean, I know that with a lot of his students and everything, he was, you know, kind of had a father figure. You know, he's kind of a mentor. Of course, he was a composer, inventor, and a great, you know, drummer as well. But he's a hip guy. You know, I think a lot of that came out his drums. You know, for that time, this is a hip drum company, you know?
Yeah. So, obviously, you mentioned a little bit about the 90s and stuff. I'm assuming that he had some fun doing it. It seems like it didn't blow up and become the next, like, you know, Pearl or something like that. But what happened with that stuff? And then maybe take us through to the end of his life. Because he's obviously no longer with us, correct?
Right. Yeah, he passed away actually in 2020. That's a year ago in January. I think it was like January 31st. And he lived to be like, I think he was 90 years old when he passed away. So, he actually bought back a lot of the Zico's company, the whole drum company was in storage at the drum shop there in Fort Wayne. And I guess he used to buy a lot of stuff from maybe some like the throw offs, maybe parts from them or something. But I can't remember exactly how it got there. But supposedly it was in storage here. And they had to, they moved it to there because it's maybe probably cheaper. And actually, I got a phone call from, this is the guy, the investor that owned 51% of the company. He called me one day. It's like around 1991, 92, if I had room for but 10 pallets. I said, all right. I said, no, I really do not. But, you know, but somehow he made it around and made his way to Bill, and Bill actually bought the company, all the remains of it back. And that's how they kind of planted a seed for the next, you know, generation, or kind of making the, I guess, full trip around, you know, 360, you know, back to where he was at. Yeah. Made a full circle back. And so he didn't make, you know, use some of the lugs. He started bending his own lugs with out of aluminum and everything, and a can make and everything. They're a little bit, the drums he came out with then, the stealth drums, what he called them, the lugs and some of the hardware was kind of spacey looking again. And he was making them down that we call it the old Cook building downtown for a while. And he was doing everything by hand. He was, you know, really working it pretty hard. He had the oven down there as well, the big oven that they, you know, they heated the acrylics up with. He had that and the molds. He was going full into it. And then he brought his son into it, help him out, who lives in Canada, and he was played a big part into helping him out, you know, make him everything. But I think by the early 2000s, like around 2003 or so, he was just ready to retire. I think it was just, you know, wasn't really ready to, you know, kind of go with the ups and downs of the music industry, which again, a lot more newer trends were coming in, and decided to kind of call it quits. So I think he might have made a few more drums. I think maybe his son did, you know, up in, like I said, up in Canada. And they finally, he didn't want, so I guess supposedly he did not want the drum cut to be sold to anybody else and harming the reputation of the drums or anything like that. So I heard he destroyed the molds and everything. Why heard?
Oh boy.
I took him to a scrapyard. So
it's dramatic.
It is kind of dramatic. I didn't know that till the other day. I've heard that. So
yeah.
So I guess that the story is, took a 360, then it pretty much, you know, kind of put a sharp into things there. But
yeah, if he can't have it, no one can. It's right. Destroyed now.
I heard the same thing was happening with tricks on drums too, but I don't know.
I heard that too, and someone told me it's not.
Folkloric probably stuff. I don't know.
I've been working on doing a Trixon episode for a long time, and I keep getting dead ends because people will say, I can't do it. You need to go to, and I'm going to mispronounce his name, but Ingo, I believe, in Germany. But he's not super confident in his English, and I haven't talked to him about a year and a half or a year. But people don't want to do it because they say he's the man. But I think I mentioned that at one point where, oh, I read that like the founder of Trixon got buried with all of his drums or something, or he destroyed them all. And someone told me, no, that's not true. But I can't confirm or deny, but I can just continue to spread that rumor.
there's a lot of folkloric stuff happens in the music business, you know, but
yeah.
And of course, other businesses for industries as well. Yeah. I heard that he was kind of mad because, I think I heard like in the late '90s before he passed away, I guess he didn't want anybody else to, you know, to make his drums or anything anymore. And since it wasn't the biggest success, I guess, he supposedly had a bulldozer dig a big hole in the ground.
Yeah.
He threw everything in there. That's what, you know, I've heard. But, you know.
Yeah. Who knows?
Not to go off on a tangent here, though. I heard that Ringo actually wanted to play a Trixon kit before he went to Ludwig. Yeah. And he went to that. I think it was Arbiter was a big distributor over there in Great Britain. And he just got Ludwig a few weeks before that, and I think he did see some in the window. Ringo was, you know, familiar with Ludwig too as well. He really liked him, but I heard for a second that he was thinking about playing Trixon, so he still got hip, so he got, you know, more hip to Ludwig and stuff. But kind of interesting how that would have changed the whole drumming world and history of the Beatles and everything, you know, to a certain extent. It'd been interesting what would happen with that. But
yeah. Man, the world would be totally different.
Yeah, all the Trixon drums that'd be out there right now would be kind of interesting, you know.
Yeah, but it didn't work out that way. I'm sure Trixon would have been extremely happy. And I know, you know, obviously Buddy played it briefly, but
that's right. Yeah, that's when they had the Vox name on there.
Yeah, Vox, exactly. Yeah,
they licensed the Vox name on there for a while. It was kind of interesting. It's all pretty good. I mean, it's all good that he chose Ludwig. That's a good choice, I think.
It worked out.
Yeah.
Well, Wes, why don't you tell people as we finish up here, you know, I'm sure you do online sales and all that stuff. So why don't you talk about your shop a little bit and then we'll kind of wrap up here.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, we've been in business now, I guess, you know, 37 years, and we're a full line percussion shop. Of course, we sell drum sets, cymbals, cymbal stands, all the, you know, hardware for drums. But we also sell a lot of hand percussion, ethnic percussion from all over the world. We sell electronic drums, and we're really into cymbals, snare drums, and things like that, which are part of our, you know, specialty as well. We have a lot of that stuff in stock and a very good selection. And everybody that works with us is very passionate about drums, and we love music and love drumming. So it's always a good reason to go to your drum shop. You know, we appreciate everybody that's done business with us before. And thanks. Thank you for letting me mention that.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And it's Explores
Percussion and Drums. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's Explores, correct?
Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
Percussion and Drums. What's your website?
It's actually, that's exploresdrums.com website. Okay. Yeah. And you can type explorespercussion.com too. That'll work as well. Exploresdrums.com.
Awesome. Yeah. And you're a dude who owns a drum shop in 2021, who I'm sure has been through some tough times over the last year. But you know, you made it through, and
It's been interesting times, you know, for sure, for everybody as well. But yeah, it's been, you know, I think some of our online sales has definitely helped us out. We're a pretty diversified shop. We deal a little bit with schools, and we also do repairs, you know, and recovering and restoration of drums as well. And that's definitely helped us out to be diversified like that, you know.
Yeah,
so,
I'm sure.
And we do lessons as well too. Of course, lessons during the pandemic was not very good at all. It's very strange. In fact, we had no lessons going on for a while at all there, because all the teachers just had to do it online, because, you know, everybody was quarantined, you know, for almost 14 months. But
yeah,
by the first of the year, we started kind of getting back into it. It's kind of about half and half. There's a lot of parents that people have, like the younger players, I don't think they didn't want to put their child in a room with a drummer or another human, you know, that close up. And
no.
So, and we still exercise mask a little bit right now if the customer has a mask and all that good stuff. So,
yeah. Cool. Well, then I want to also give a shout out to Mr. Andrew Moore, who suggested this episode and got me in touch with Wes, who Wes told me is a great drummer, but he's also a great dentist, which is,
yes,
those are two good things.
Andrew's really, you know, he really is a great dentist, a great staff. Actually, I'd like to say something about his father, man. His father taught, I think, dentistry for like 50 years or so at the UMKC. University of Missouri here in town, which is that's the longest teaching career I think I've ever heard from anybody.
Yeah, 50 years.
Yeah, that's 50 years teaching. It's a big dental school here that's down here at University of Missouri, but that's kind of unique. But yeah, Andrew's great. Ryan, I thank him for mentioning this to you, and it's been a great pleasure for you, and you know, giving me the opportunity to do this, especially, you know, talking about, I think, subject, you know, Zico's drums, which definitely deserves to be, you know, talk about it and for sure.
Absolutely. And, literally we first talked in August of 2020 and now it's June of 2021. So like I always say, these take a long time to just kind of like things fall off and then they go on. But, congrats, your daughter's getting married soon. So that's extremely cool.
Yep, I'm sure next week is an exciting week.
Just stay out of the way.
Yeah. That's very crazy right now at times.
Cool. Well, on that note, Wes, this has been amazing and one that's been on my list for a long time. So I appreciate you taking the time to share with me. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
If you like this podcast, find me on social media at Drum History and please share, rate, and leave a review. And let me know topics that you would like to learn about in the future. Until next time, keep on learning.